One of the issues I have been worried about in the Russia-Ukraine war from the beginning, which unfortunately is now nearing its four-year mark since this war began, is the possibility of expansion, of moving beyond the borders of Ukraine, of involving NATO, possibly, God help us, even the United States. And obviously, anytime you talk about that, you have the risk of nuclear escalation. Now, for the majority of this time, this war, it looked like, okay, we're going to be all right. There was some scares in the early part of it, but then it kind of settled in and it looked like, all right, it's just going to morass and just fester inside of Ukraine. But now then, as this war has gone further and it hasn't been brought to an end, we are having the increasing potential that this war could indeed expand. And that would be bad for everybody, potentially catastrophic for mankind. And I don't think that that's talking too much in a hyperbole, especially given where things have been going of late. And one of the biggest problems that we've had is because this is one of the potential consequences of our abject unwillingness to bring this war to a conclusion and to an end when the end has already been known. It's been clear. If you want to just drag it out, maybe since 2023, that's at the latest. Probably before that, as I've argued throughout. But if you want to say, sure, we prove it first, that was when it was. So our unwillingness in the last two full years now has us to the point to where people are openly talking about nuclear weapons tests and the advancement of nuclear delivery systems. And to try and figure all this out and figure out where it may go and what we can do maybe to stop some of this insanity is the ever amazing Scott Horton, author of Provoked: How Washington Started a New Cold War with Russia. And unfortunately, that's very relevant to what we're going to talk about today. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Colonel. Happy to be here with you.
Well, listen, for those who may not have seen, I know everybody who knows you probably is well aware of this, but for some of our audience who may not have been quite as familiar with your work, what is Provoked all about? Because as everyone knows, this war was unprovoked, and the Russians just woke up one day, I think it was on a Tuesday, and Putin just says, you know what, how's about we just invade that country over there, the Ukraine, I think they call it. What do you say is the truth?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, that's why I named it that, of course, is because they repeated that a million times over, this propaganda story, which if you just stop and read between the lines a little bit, it's pretty obvious that the reason they named it that, the unprovoked attack, is because they didn't want you questioning what had provoked the attack, because then you would blame the Republicans and the Democrats in Washington, D.C. for putting our friends, ostensibly the Ukrainians, into this position of getting into a fight with their bigger neighbor that they can't possibly win and that we are not willing to win for them. Who knows if we're able or not? I think it's generally agreed, as you were, you know, implying there earlier, that if America and Russia ever fought, everybody dies and everybody loses. There's no war. If we have a war, it'll escalate to nuclear war. And if it escalates to nuclear war, as we talked about on your show before, then it's use them or lose them. Somebody launches everything they got, and that's the end of everything. And that is how virtually every war game plays out, in that same sort of fashion. So that's why it was a height of emergency that this fight is going on at all. As I said, as soon as the war broke out, you know, they should have done everything they could to stop it. But then as soon as the war broke out, I, called for all 8 billion human beings to just call for general strike. That's it. We can't let this continue this way because how dangerous it is. And then show them the profile view of the thing there, Danny, show them the side. It's there you go. So that's why it's so thick. And by the way, don't be intimidated, audience, because about a third of that is footnotes, because I knew that the burden is on me. Show them, Dan. The burden is on me to prove my case. And so and I accept that. And so I did. I have 7,000 citations, or it's almost 9,000 citations, 7,000 footnotes, 8,900 something citations to make my case. And then the story begins at the end of the last Cold War. And what did the George H.W. Bush, that is Bush Senior, administration decide to do? How did they decide to handle it? And it could have been worse, but the bottom line is the policy was America's going to stay in Europe and stay the dominant power in Europe. And not only that, but we're moving east. We're going to eventually incorporate the entire former Warsaw Pact, and eventually even, although I don't think the Bush people thought this much, but well, yeah, in the case of the Baltics, including even some of the former Soviet republics. And when Bill Clinton started it, Bush Sr. had promised, don't worry, Russia, we're not going to do that. NATO is going to become a political organization. We're going to replace it as the security organization in Europe with the CSCE, which you guys are already members of, now known as the OSCE, which was a lie. They were just shining them on. And the same thing in the Clinton years. They said, no, we're going to do the Partnership for Peace. NATO will be a political organization. Think of it like the EU plus America, and not a big deal, nothing for you to worry about. And there won't be an alliance because we don't need an alliance because there's no enemy. Why would we need an alliance? So instead, we're going to have a security partnership. And you and the Baltics and Belarus and Ukraine and everybody will all be members of it together at the same time. So it'll be fine. Neutrality baked in. But they never meant that either. The plan always was to expand the NATO military alliance at the Russians' expense. And all of Bush and Baker's promises in 1990 and in 1991, as well as all of Bill Clinton's promises in 1993 and especially in 1997, that, well, we definitely won't put military equipment into the new NATO nations. Those were then overridden by George W. Bush, who expanded NATO by nine nations, I believe it was, in 2004, and including into the Baltic states, and started putting these anti-missile stations in Romania and Poland and the radars in the Czech Republic, which, as we've discussed before.
Yeah.
This is what you call the Aegis onshore missile system, which is for defensive missiles, for Sparrow defensive missiles. And they're fired out of the Mark 41 missile launcher or MK 41 missile launcher. But the thing is that launcher can also host Tomahawks. So this was seen as American. It really was America, at least violating the spirit of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, as well as the promises in the German Reunification Treaty. As well as the promises in the Founding Act, the NATO-Russia Council Founding Act of 1997, where they had promised not to do this. And so that obviously is a security threat to the Russians.
Let me just kind of break in for a second, because all of this is leading somewhere. And I'm going to go back and hit some of this other things, a couple of specific points. Mm-hmm. But so you've been talking about stuff going back to 1993, et cetera, and it's just rolling up to this point. So this is not something that just happened in 2022 or even 2014, for that matter, or 2007, et cetera. It keeps going back all the way before that. But now here we are today. And so earlier today, we had Vladimir Putin is announcing a lot of his strategic advancements and developments way beyond where it was even in 2022. Watch this.
Russia, like all other nuclear powers, develops its nuclear potential, develops its strategic potential. All our plans for creating prospective weapon systems, for developing the defense industrial complex, and for equipping Russia's army and navy with modern equipment and armaments are being carried out. We have created and placed on duty and have begun serial production of the medium-range missile system, Oreshnik. In the current year, we will place into trial combat service, and next year, already on combat duty, systems with the heavy intercontinental missile, Sarmat. At last, Russia is acquiring the unlimited-range cruise missile, Burevestnik, and the unmanned underwater vehicle, Poseidon, with nuclear power plants.
So now then we have in one nice little tidy soundbite here, we have talking about the Sarmat, which is a huge nuclear weapon, the Oreshnik, which is a medium-range missile, new category, we can't even stop, the Burevestnik, which is allegedly a nuclear-powered cruise missile that has unlimited range, and then we have the Poseidon. So all of that stuff, none of it existed in 1993. Some of it didn't even exist, I don't think, in 2022. And as you said, I think the last time you were on our show, it was Bush getting out of the ABM treaty and Trump getting out of the INF treaty, which was the direct progenitor of a lot of this stuff. Scott, where are we going and what in the hell do we need to do to stop this progression that we've seen?
Yeah. Well, now, first of all, I think Trump didn't actually tear up the INF treaty until after Putin announced that new generation of nukes for the first time in 2018. And just a minor clarification there. It really was. And as he said in that speech, it was when Bush tore up the anti-ballistic missile treaty that he decided he had to do this. Obama, of course, you know, made it even more important when he announced the whole new renovation of America's nuclear program in, I guess, 2010. When he had to do that to compromise with the Republicans to get the New START treaty passed. They have something called the Nuclear Missile Caucus. And this is in the Senate, people who represent the states that launched the nuclear missiles, the Minutemen, And their job is to bring home the pork for the nuclear weapons complex, right? It's just crazy the way this system works, but it is what it is. And then, yes, so now what you're talking about, what you described there and paraphrasing in Putin's speech there is what he's saying is that there's a new nuclear arms race and we're losing it. And now, you know, quite frankly, in the event of a nuclear war between the United States and Russia, we have 1,000 targets in each country, all of which get destroyed. So what they have here, you know, and I'm not the world's greatest nuclear warfare strategist expert or whatever, but it seems to me that all four of these new systems are essentially, I mean, the hypersonics can be fitted with conventional weapons, as we've seen in Ukraine already. But otherwise, even still, what these really serve as, hopefully, and in intent, I think, is just as further deterrent to let the American government know that they do not have an advantage against Russia. If you thought that you were anywhere close to achieving a first strike capability against us, think again. Mutually assured destruction is still the law of the land. Because again, you know, if they, with all of this new stuff, let's say they have 100 of these new cruise missiles and they got, you know, 50 of these new torpedoes and whatever, it doesn't make any difference. We lose San Francisco anyway in a nuclear war with Russia, whether it's a torpedo or whether it's ICBM coming over the pole. Okay. And so in essence, it should be a further deterrent to conflict. While I don't think it does actually give the Russians a strategic advantage against the United States in nuclear war in any real quantifiable way, I doubt that it does. If anything, it probably tilts the balance a little bit back toward the center, where the Americans were building up more and more of an advantage.
And I argue it doesn't tilt anything anywhere. This whatever it is, like 15 times over or 10 times over, or one time over capability to destroy the world. Once you get to that one, 15 or 65, it doesn't make any difference. So it doesn't change anything. We already have the ability to destroy each other.
Here's one would be like, okay, if you're the president, well, never mind that, but just like overall, a situation where a hypersonic missile can get to Washington in such speed that you'd only have 5 seconds or 5 minutes to decide, or 7 minutes to decide instead of 25 to decide what to do, right? That kind of thing. That ought to make a difference in the minds of the strategists in Washington, that if things escalate with these hypersonics shortening reaction time so much, that should give us all the more incentive to cool things down overall. And so that we don't have to make any kind of close call. We don't have to wonder whether that's really a hypersonic on our scope.
Well, that's what we should do. We shouldn't have even needed that. I'll just point that out there. But in case we needed one more piece of information, the Russians provided it today. So that video I just showed you was from yesterday. Russia went a little bit further today. First of all, their Minister of Defense, Belousov, Gary, if you can toss that one up there, he was quoted at a meeting earlier today of saying that the United States plans to deploy missiles to Europe, the flight time of which would be no more than 6 to 7 minutes. At the same time, Washington does not hide its plans, playing out a scenario of a punitive nuclear strike on Russia. And the Americans are not going to return to the treaty on the limitation of offensive nuclear weapons. They do not need it. Against this background, Belousov suggested that the Putin not postpone preparations for nuclear testing for a long time, but bring the Novaya Zemlya test site into working order. That's what Belousov said. At that same meeting, Putin added his part.
Неукоснительно придерживалась по договору о всеобъемлющем запрещении и планов отойти от этих обязательств. В случае, если Соединенные Штаты либо другие государства участники, то и Россия тоже должна будет соответствующим по подготовке испытаний ядерного оружия.
So you see, Belousov was saying, hey, America is going to do this, and they're potentially planning on a first strike against us. So I think we should bring the test site up to case. At least Putin says, well, we're going to stick with the NPT, but if they do, we will do the same thing in response. What do you make of that seemingly just ooching us a little bit further and further to nuclear confrontation?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we have to assume that all that is scripted, right? So if Putin's guy says that, then he checked with the boss before he those words were uttered publicly. So then Putin gets to play what, you know, good cop to his advisor who's urging a harder line stance. But I would just urge anyone in Washington to consider the situation. Here Putin is saying, look, I'm not going to start exploding atomic warheads unless you do first. Now, Trump, as we talked about last week, the Russians started testing these platforms, delivery vehicles, and announcing them and boasting about them. And then Trump seemed to say, although there was like a weird word attached to it that made it slightly unclear, but he seemed to say it's time to start testing warheads again. It's time to start detonating fission and or fusion bombs. And so now they're saying, well, look, we won't unless you do. So, you know, and America tests delivery vehicles all the time, by the way, 3-stage rockets and whatever it is.
Yeah, we did a Minuteman 3 today, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. So,
so if that's what he meant, okay, that's fine. We do that all the time.
Sure.
There's no problem with that, as long as it doesn't mean anything further. And when he had a chance in 60 Minutes on Sunday to clarify, he didn't clarify it in whether he meant a nuclear weapons test or a nuclear platform test. We can hope that this means it was the latter and that Trump is not actually crazy, but I'm just uncomfortable being ambiguous on this. It seems like it would be better to be clear.
And look, if it was 2002 or 1999 or whatever, then and the American government said, you know what, we really want to test our designs with no one particularly in mind, but we just have, you know, some new inventions on how to fuse hydrogen isotopes and we want to practice. That would be one thing. But here we are in a hot border dispute with Russia, 300 miles from Moscow, which is just absolutely intolerable. And, you know, and by the way, I was almost done before about the lead up to the thing. It was the encroachment in NATO and the ongoing civil war in eastern Ukraine that had begun after America overthrew the government there in 2014 and absolutely refused to implement the peace deals that our own government had rubber stamped. I mean, Merkel made the deal, but Obama rubber stamped it. The UN Security Council passed a resolution saying Minsk II is the law of the land. Implement it. That's all Biden had to do was implement that thing. And so this was an ongoing hot war since March of 14, when John Brennan is the one who went over there and ordered the interim government to start the war. And so that was what put the Russians in this position. The book is called Provoked. It's not called Justified, because I do, and I have a part in the book where I talk about, I think that Putin had options. I don't think his back was all the way in the corner and had no choice. But it is absolutely the West, led by Washington, D.C., that has put the Russians and especially the Ukrainians in this position. And now, I mean, just think of how absurd this is, that in the year 2025, when the Soviet Union has been gone since 1991, that you and I are even having this conversation about America and Russia doing a nuclear arms race and nuclear brinksmanship and considering going back to testing nuclear weapons, threatening each other's capital cities and more populations, civilian populations, with Armageddon. And over what? When world communism is over. I mean, we're talking about Republican Russia with a red, white, and blue flag and a center-right conservative Christian Republican president. Who gives a damn about the Donbass? How could anyone in the world think that the fate of Dnipropetrovsk is more important than the fate of humanity here, which is...
Let me ask you, Scott, because this is all about when if someone's listening to you who's you know, on the Lindsey Graham wing of, I would say reality, but we'll just say mythology, they see, okay, but all I've heard since 2022, closing in on 4 years now, is all about Putin is Hitler, and they're coming after us. And my God, if we don't stop them here. I mean, how many times have we've kind of mocked on that, but yet it keeps getting said. And people who don't watch shows like this, they hear that all the time, and they are afraid that this is a revanchist, you know, or the other thing, not just Hitler, or maybe he wants to recreate the USSR, et cetera. All these evil, wicked things ascribed to him, because that scares us. And my God, we have to get ready. How do you pierce through that reality?
Well, look, I mean, especially for American conservatives, those of you who've ever served in the military or law enforcement, you know this firsthand. Otherwise, you know this about every other part of government, that government doesn't work. It's their incentives are made to fail upwards. And they have what's called the public choice theory set of incentives where there is no real national interest. You just have the interests of the people involved. Remember the Politico headline. Joe Biden's White House told Politico, we have to keep this war going through the election. We can't be seen to have having lost a war before the election. Right. So this is about them. This is about Joe Biden and Antony Blinken. It's not about Ukraine. It's not about you or me or the fate of mankind. It's about these ne'er-do-wells at best in charge. And so for conservative-leaning people out there, like, is it really so difficult to consider the possibility that this is just all Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and Joe Biden's fault and, like, okay, maybe a little bit George W. Bush? And we all know that Donald Trump wanted to solve these problems in his first term. I'm not saying he necessarily could have or knew what to do, but he absolutely was sincere about trying to get along with Russia in his first term. And so what'd they do? They framed him for treason and completely handcuffed him. They even impeached him for holding up an arms sale to Ukraine for a couple of days that the Ukrainians swore they didn't even notice a delay. And they impeached him over that to refuse to allow him to solve these problems in the short time that he had. And then Joe Biden came in and spent 2021 being Joe Biden. And not only being Joe Biden, but being Joe Biden at what, 79 or already 80 or 81 or whatever at that time, absolutely out of his mind, led around by the absolute incompetent idiot, Antony Blinken, and who refused to negotiate in good faith. And you can see in the book, I have a whole section that's just 2021, where the very final last straws clearly were in the fall of 21, when the State Department again put out a big giant thing saying, we swear to God that someday we are going to bring Ukraine into the NATO military alliance and there's nothing anyone can do to stop it. Then you had the Turks pouring in brand new drones for Kiev's side. And then you had the Department of Defense put out a brand new thing in November promising further military integration and interoperability with the Ukrainian military, essentially making them a de facto member of the NATO military alliance, even without the war guarantee. And then when the Russians proposed their treaties, as you and I talked about at the time, they just simply refused to negotiate in good faith. And if you look at the treaties, you know, if you start out with, oh, Putin, Stalin, and he just wants an excuse, you might assume that that treaty was written to be a dead letter, right? Like Madeleine Albright's Rambouillet Accord, where it's a proposal that's made to be rejected. Well, that's not true. And if you look at this, and I talked to experts at the time, and I have quotes in the book from Biden White House officials admitting to the Post and the Times that these terms are reasonable. We could negotiate these treaties. But then what they do, they refuse to negotiate those treaties at all. They came into the negotiations saying, we're not signing any treaty. Forget that. You want to do a deal on NATO? We're not even going to talk to you about a deal on NATO and neutrality. That is not even up for discussion at all. Derek Chollet, who was part of the negotiation, said, all we would say about NATO is it's a defensive alliance and that'll be good enough for you. And then on missiles, they'd said, well, we could have an agreement, but we're certainly not signing a treaty. And as far as that agreement, well, we'll have our deputy undersecretary of state for nothing meet with you in 6 weeks. And then nothing happened. And then they never had the talks and they refused to sign any deal to promise to keep missiles out of Ukraine. And so it was just, American security is a government program. It's the biggest big government program of all. And there are so many people, hell, even in my book, when I wrote my book, Fool's Errand, about time to get out of Afghanistan in 2017, I have a whole thing at the end of that book about how I am not saying pivot to Ukraine now, because everybody knew. There's so many people who knew, oh, now that we're leaving Afghanistan, they're going to have to find something to do. And what they do, they immediately pivoted to Ukraine. And a huge part of it, I'm not saying it's everything, but a huge part of it. And everyone knows this. Everyone knows this. Ike Eisenhower coined the term military industrial complex. Joe Biden and his people call it the defense industrial base. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's real and it's spectacular. It's the reason that Americans are born, so that we can finance and fund the defense industrial base, the most crucial aspect of our entire society. And they would even brag again to Politico, that's why we have to have this war, just to sustain our defense industrial base. What does that mean? That means Boeing and Lockheed, especially Raytheon, General Atomics, General Dynamics, SIAC, et al., and all their pet think tanks, they have a gun to your head. And they make us do this so they can steal our money from us. It's as simple as that, Danny. And then,
let me ask you a question here, because I've talked to some of my British colleagues here of late, and they argue that this is an equal or something close to an equal British-U.S. cabal, if you want to use that term, and that there was an overt plan from quite a while back, hoping that they would get into a conflict between Ukraine and Russia. And there is some evidence, and this is I'm having to read between the lines here, is that when Volodymyr Zelensky was elected in 2019 on a platform to end the then civil war that was going on between east and west of Ukraine, is that then he was, I don't know if the right word is compelled or coerced or convinced to change tactics. And in March of 2021, Colonel Jacques Beau has been on our channel a lot and talked about this. He's got it covered in his own book. Out of nowhere, he comes out and says, here is this law passed in March 2021 that says we are going to retake the temporarily occupied Crimea, which is a cape in front of a bull for the Russians, because that was non-negotiable for them. And everything started from that point. Is all of this connected?
Yes, absolutely. And that's just another one of the points in my book as well, when on that section on the year 2021. Also in the spring of 21, he seized the property and including the media channel of Putin's very close friend, Viktor Medvedchuk. It was like the last major pro-Russian oligarch in the country. And with Biden's approval and declared support, avowed support, seized his media channel and all of that. And so there are a great many provocations, you know, through the year 2021 leading up to that. And you're absolutely right about Zelensky. He ran on peace. So did Poroshenko run on peace. Poroshenko even made a deal where I promise peace if Dmitry Firtash will agree to allow me to become president. That's how he became, that Dmitry Firtash is Hillary Clinton's friend. That's how he became president in the first place and then immediately went to war kept the war going. Zelensky ran on peace and crushed Poroshenko in 2019. And then as soon as he got in, there were two major forces that prevented him from negotiating in good faith with the Russians. The first was the Trump administration. And you can blame Trump. He's the man in the chair behind the desk. It's his responsibility. I have to admit, though, I have no knowledge or even reason to believe that Trump knew what his ambassador was doing. I mean, who knows if he did or not. But his ambassador, William Taylor, told Zelensky not to implement the Germans' new proposal for implementing Minsk II. The German foreign minister is a guy named Steinmeier, and he introduced the Steinmeier formula that said, we're going to take the Minsk II peace deal and we're going to reorder the operations for how we implement it in a way that's a compromise that hopefully will be good for both sides, because Kiev was refusing, with American support, had been refusing to implement Minsk II by claiming, no, the rebels have to essentially surrender all the territory to Kiev first, and then everything else can happen after that, which of course was never the deal and was, you know, a deal killer when they did that. So Steinmeier said, well, here's a new order of operations for implementing the deal. And Ambassador William Taylor told Zelensky, the same as Ambassador Zimmerman helped destroy the peace deal for the Lisbon deal for Bosnia back in 1992. He told him, don't sign that. He says, Steinmeier doesn't know what it is. Nobody knows what it is. It's not anything. Don't do it. At the same time, the other force that was preventing peace were the Nazis. That is the Patriot of Ukraine gang, the Svoboda Party, Right Sector, and the Azov Battalion, and all of those guys, Dmitry Yarosh and Andriy Beletsky and other associates. I'm not sure Andriy Perubi or not, but especially Yarosh and Beletsky threatened to murder Poroshenko first and then Zelensky later if they would dare negotiate in good faith with the Russians on that sunk cost fallacy. Everybody who's died fighting the Russians so far, they're heroes, and their sacrifice was the ultimate sacrifice for the glory of Ukraine. But if they lose the war because the government gives up, well, then they will have died in vain. And so we can't have that, and we'll kill you first, Mr. President, was, you know, Dmitry Yarosh said that we'll hang him from a tree on Kramatorsk Street. Always pronounce that wrong, forgive me, but the main drag in Kiev. And Andriy Beletsky had said the same thing. Like, dude, you'll just get shot in the head. That'll be the end of you. You're not. There's even footage of the famous clip of Zelensky insisting, I'm not a loser. I'm the president. You have to do what I say.
Yeah.
And it's Andriy Beletsky himself telling him, listen, if you make 1,000 of us withdraw from this town, I'll bring back 10,000. I'm in charge here, not you, punk, says the white leader, Andriy Beletsky, of the 3rd Separate Infantry Division, or now the 3rd Army Corps, the Azov Battalion.
Yeah, and there you have it. And so we're where we are here and are continuing to escalate. Do you see any prospect that anything can ramp us down from this, whether it's a decision made or maybe it's just the defeat of the Ukrainian armed forces where they just the resistance collapse? How do you see that playing out?
Yes, well, look, on the second point first, I mean, I think as you and your colleagues have said all the time, and this only makes sense, of course, that time is on Russia's side here. They've been losing. I mean, pardon me, they've been winning, but slowly. Taking more and more territory. But as you have stipulated, especially Danny, that it's a war of attrition. And the Ukrainian side says that too. We're not fighting for territory. We're fighting to kill as many Russians as possible. And then one day their lines will break and then we'll take back the rest of our country. That's what the Russians say about the Ukrainians too. We're not really fighting for land as much as, and there are some strategic areas, of course, they want to take. They're closing in on the very last of Provost right now and all that. But essentially, what they're doing is just grinding up the other guys until one day their forces break, and then the Russians can just have the run of the place. The Ukrainian military at that point reverts to militia form, right, and starts fighting an insurgency from the other side of the river, something like that. As far as diplomacy that could end the war before the Russians just win and get what they want, I do think so. That it's possible, literally.
Well, tell me something that I don't know because I don't see it. I don't see any chance of it. So tell me something that makes me give me some optimism.
Yeah. Well, that was the second part. Yeah, I think it is. I think it is impossible politically, but I think just like overall scheme of things, like Trump could say to Kiev, in all due seriousness, it is over. You're not getting one more bullet, one more dime. All support is over. And yeah, they're going to say I'm stabbing you in the back and leaving you high and dry and all that, but I don't care. I want the fighting ended. I demand that you stop, or at the very least that you understand you're not getting one more scrap of intelligence from our guys in Germany. You're not getting one more bullet for your rifles. American support for your side of the war is done. And they need to have to go to the Russians and say, look, that's a pretty big thing I just did right there. Now, what you're going to have to do is draw the lines where they are now. And in exchange for that, then we'll drop all sanctions and we will launch a full offensive of normalization with Russia and the United States and the rest of the West. And like, as in the new Cold War is canceled, and bring the man to Washington, D.C., take him to the ball game, get back in the INF and the Open Skies treaties, save New START, go ahead and get in START 2 that George W. Bush killed back when he tore up the ABM treaty, get back in the ABM treaty, sign brand new deals for Exxon to develop oil resources in Siberia and whatever companies to handle some logging, whatever we can do to integrate our, and look, we're both resource exporters. So there's a lot of competition between America and Russia in that sense, but there's got to be a way that we can integrate economic projects. And I'm talking all things being equal. I'm a libertarian here. I don't want the government really doing anything except to stop doing things. That would be the first and foremost, is just drop all sanctions, end the Cold War with Russia on our side unilaterally. Just this whole thing is wrong. This has been John McCain and Joe Biden's policy this whole time. We are not bound by it. But at the same time, hey, and we're talking Donald Trump here, not me in the office, right? Donald Trump. Hey, Putin, don't make me look like a jerk, man. I'm really bending over backwards here to fix this. You do your part. And I don't, look, you're right that, and obviously the other major point here to reiterate, the Russians ain't done winning yet. They don't want to stop where they are. They still have a quarter of Donetsk to take, and they still have a third of Zaporozhye and Kherson. So to climb down and draw the line where it is now, I think maybe it is absolutely impossible to ask that of the Russians, certainly in Donetsk. There were trial balloons. I saw someone said I was completely delusional about this, but I read in the Wall Street Journal that somebody in the Kremlin told them they might be willing to climb down on Zaporozhye and Kherson. Now, I don't know if that was really what Putin told them to say, or, you know, how well that truly represents his point of view, but maybe. And is anybody even trying right now? You know, what we heard was we're going to go talk in Hungary because we think we got this solved. And then no, actually, no. Lavrov talked to Rubio and they decided that we're not there yet. Well, how about just Lavrov talks to Rubio every day until this gets solved, right? At least Antony Blinken isn't up there with his fingers in his ears refusing to answer the damn telephone. I mean, Blinken refused to talk to Lavrov.
And bragged about it, I'll point out.
Yeah. So at least they're talking. And I think, look, it ain't praise for Putin to say that the guy is a sober adult. He understands how dangerous it is to have NATO and the Russian Federation in a conflict like this as it exists now. And he understands the potential for this thing to slip out of control and all of that. You know, back to
well, and by the way, just according to Doug McGregor, who we had on earlier today, Donald Trump knows the same thing. So I would like to hope that we can get those two guys to finally come up and do whatever it takes to get this done, so we can actually literally end the killing and get this
one
thing.
One more thing on that, Danny. And I'm sorry if I said this on your show last week, but Richard Nixon went over there and shook hands with Mao Zedong, the guy who killed more people than any other person ever killed. Right? He's like Genghis Khan plus Tamerlane is Mao Zedong. And Nixon went over there and said, put her there, pal. You know what? Business is business. And you and I got to get along for reasons. And they shook hands. They made peace. And then they said, let the deputy undersecretaries meet and work out the details later. The big issues we can solve right now, but we're going to start with a handshake. We're going to start with we're friends now. Then we're going to work out the peace. Now, if Richard goddamn Nixon can work that out with Mao godforsaken tongue, then, man, peace is possible. I just don't want to hear it, man. You know, Ron Paul, you say all the time, Jack Kennedy went and met with Khrushchev. Khrushchev. Like, do you not know who Khrushchev was? Khrushchev is the guy that did the Holodomor for Joseph Stalin. That's who he was. He was the guy that did the Holodomor. And Jack Kennedy said, hey, you know what? Instead of nuclear blowing all of ourselves up, we should sit at a table and talk, shouldn't we? Was Jack Kennedy washing the evil from Khrushchev? Was he like somehow justifying or sanctifying any of the actions that Khrushchev had ever taken? No, he was recognizing the fact that guess who's the general secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union right now? This guy.
Yeah.
And so that's who we have to deal with.
That's
so
deal with, yeah.
There you go. I mean, that's all you need to know that the precedent is set for any American leader to meet with any foreign leader and solve whatever problem outstanding. Sure.
Couldn't agree with you more. Absolutely. Now that we've gotten that one resolved and we know what needs to happen.
That's right.
Let's take a look at the other issue, which is unfortunately bubbling up to the surface, which could be beginning. God help us if it gets there. But we can't ignore that a lot of things have been going on in our own hemisphere in Venezuela. And right now, the USS Ford, the aircraft carrier with 90 warplanes on board, is apparently only days away from being into strike range inside of the window to where they could attack in Venezuela. President Trump has not hesitated and shied back from saying he has given the CIA opportunity to go inside of and make attack targets inside of Venezuela. You've had both Lindsey Graham and Senator Scott have openly and exquisitely specifically said, yeah, I think that Maduro has to go. He'll either be assassinated, he'll flee, or we'll go and get him out there. I mean, that's as stark and direct as you can possibly get. Where the hell is this going?
God, I really don't know, man. And I don't know who's doing. You tell me if you know who's got really good reporting out of the White House. Maybe I should call Kurt Mills. He's got good connections. Like, there are very few people who have good sources in the White House who can tell us like what these people are really thinking. This could all be a show, or it could be that Rubio has really convinced the president that this is a doable thing. But, Venezuela is a huge country. It's much bigger than Iraq, has a massive population, and, you know, is just not the case. They're like, oh, they're going to greet us with candy and flowers, and all of this and thank America for invading their country and overthrowing their government. Just because they found some sock puppets to, claim to wish to inherit the power if we can give it to them, doesn't mean that they have popular support whatsoever. And, you know, it's a very poor country, and the leftists in power are there by and large with the consent of the poor, and particularly, you know, the indigenous people and stuff like that. And so I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself. I do a lot of shows, Danny, but if we talked about this last week, but there's no American president, Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders or even Bill Clinton or anyone, where the American people would tolerate a foreign government intervening in our country to liberate us and remove this tyrant from power over our land. We would all join with whatever president to shoot them all to death first, and then we would take care of our domestic problem. Because, tell me if you've heard this one, independence matters more, matters first.
I heard that somewhere. I can't remember.
Our tyrant is our problem. And the tyrant of Venezuela is the people of Venezuela's problem. And just like after September 11th, they have, you know, if you go to college, they call it the rally around the flag effect. It happens everywhere. You attack a country, people rally around their security force.
Here just earlier this year.
That's right. So it's just is nonsense that, you know, in fact, in Iraq War II, it was slightly different, because in that situation, it was a massive ethnic type split where you had this supermajority Shiite population that wanted rid of Saddam so bad, they were willing to stand back and watch us invade. But then as soon as America decided they were staying, Muqtada al-Sadr and his guys went to war. Within 1 year, you know, the Shiites started fighting and resisting and making it known that we were not going to be able to stay after even 1 year, after we got rid of the guy that they really did want us to get rid of for them, or at least were willing to stand back and not fight when we invaded you. That there's nothing like that.
Let me ask you a question here. I've done this headline Gary's got shown up here from Politico, where Machado, after winning the Nobel Peace Prize, says, yeah, I want Trump to come in and use force to get Maduro out. That's really peaceful. What do you make of that?
Yeah. Again, look, remember the Russiagate hoax when they said that the Russians had installed Trump in power. Let's even say for hypothetical that was true, that we knew it was true at the time. And then Hillary Clinton had said, well, I demand that China intervene and overthrow Trump and install me in power to make it fair, because I should have won. What would we do? What would Americans think of that? Right? She would have less legitimacy than even Donald Trump, the recipient of the Russian assistance, because at least they didn't invade the country and kill a bunch of people to have their way. You know what I mean? It would just be it's the utmost absurdity to even draw the hypothetical, right? Hillary Clinton wouldn't dare to even consider that, as insane and hateful and horrible as she is. That would be the most counterproductive thing for her to do for her own interests. It's the same thing here. Does anyone in Venezuela think they find that really endearing, that this lady is asking the United States of America, imperial juggernaut overshadowing their everything, you know, looming over them to the north, that she's asking them to come invade to specifically give the power to her and her friends? I mean, goodness. Yeah, no. And look, we've seen this before. America's intervened in Venezuela off and on, you know, throughout this entire century. And just by the way, again, for your audience, in case anyone doesn't know me, I'm a libertarian. I'm the most anti-communist you could possibly be. The only thing I believe in actually is property rights. Okay. Like there's nothing dumber than Marxist economics in the world. There's nothing worse for the people of Venezuela than having a leftist regime in their economic policies and the way that they've implemented destroyed that country. And yet the American empire is responsible for some major proportion of that. I don't know how to measure it exactly, but we've had a massive sanctions regime on that country since 2005. And so, you know, you could still be a commie government and yet hire a French corporation to come and pump your oil for you, right? But America makes it illegal for any multinational to come and do real business with them, right? We'll put sanctions on any country that, you know, they even had to have an Iranian firm come and open some grocery stores there, because no one else in the world will do business with them. And so that's a huge part of the Venezuelan illegal immigration problem in this country right now, is not just because of the communism of Chavez and Maduro, but because the social, whatever it is, it's very commie, not entirely Marxist, but on top of that is the Americans, the Treasury Department, right? It's like the third most powerful force in the world after the DOD and the CIA, right? Maybe more powerful than the CIA. A treasury can put your whole country under a stranglehold. And so this is the same thing we've done with Cuba. since the 1960s, right? When we could have just killed them with free market capitalism a long time ago if we had just traded with them away and people could just see the benefits of markets and prices and property rights. And communism is, if you ask the Cubans, they'll tell you, communism is a good way, or their communist government has kept them independent from us. It has not provided a good standard of living or freedom for
them. Yeah, no, I've been to Cuba and I have talked to them. That's exactly what they say.
Yep. And so, look, independence first, the same as anybody. And so, and look, this is my take on the whole damn terror war and the whole new order of this era. I mean, remember the 1990s, Danny, when the year 2000 was still looming ahead of us. What's it going to be like after the year 2000? What is, George H.W. Bush called it the new world order. Well, what is the world order going to be? Well, what it should have been was a Ron Paulian foreign policy. I'd settle for Pat Buchanan, but Ron's better. And that means you bring everybody home, but you have open trade, peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none, just like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington said. And then what we could do is we could beat the world over the head about all the things that are wrong with their societies, such as they're too commie and don't have enough freedom, for example, without being blood-soaked hypocrites, see, and without having a dog in the fight, where what this is really about is a contest between Chevron and Exxon. Chevron wants to lift the sanctions and do business with Maduro. Exxon wants to murder him and steal their oil. Well, is that how we determine American foreign policy? Can't we just have the CEO of Chevron and Exxon just like duke it out in the MMA ring or something, and then, but we keep the peace with Venezuela? It shouldn't be like this at all. And
no,
there,
it shouldn't.
There, you know,
and that's something that I'm actually a big advocate of. But as it turns out, and I want to bring this up because I know a lot of people are probably listening to this going, man, that what he, this guy's saying makes a lot of sense. They may not know who Ron Paul and some of these other, or some of the younger people. But as it turns out, there is a Scott Horton Academy coming out pretty soon of foreign policy where you can actually inculcate some of these ideas. So if you could tell us a little bit about this and then tell people how they can find out more about this.
Absolutely. Thank you, Danny. And thank you for the opportunity to talk about it. Well, so it is the Scott Horton Academy of Foreign Policy and Freedom. And that is a homage to the great Dr. Paul, his great book on his speeches on foreign policy from the House floor called A Foreign Policy of Freedom, which is absolutely fantastic, by the way. And so I named it as a homage to my hero there. And this is just like Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom, where he has all these great historians and economists and so forth teaching the college education that you should have gotten college, but didn't. And so, but he built me my own. And what it is very long form courses by myself and other experts on foreign policy and other matters of freedom.
For generations, the United States has had a one party system.
There's a promo video there, which you'll find on the bottom of the splash page. And essentially, it's a very long form courses by me on the Middle East and the Cold War with Russia, which that course is not quite up yet, but it will be coming very soon. I've got the great James Bovard from the New York Post and the Libertarian Institute, the great libertarian journalist on 40 years of investigative journalism. I've got Ramzi Baroud, my Palestinian friend and regular writer at antiwar.com, who's done the reality of the Israel-Palestine conflict. And Bill Buppert, I told you about my good buddy, Bill Buppert, who you'd love this guy. You guys should be friends. I'll connect you. And he's a former army captain or lieutenant colonel and was a contractor, trained Afghan troops and all that, was attached to special operations forces and divisions around the world for a very long time and been everywhere as a combat tourist, he says. And his course is called Trail of Tears, American Stalemate and Military Failure Since 1945. And it's just fantastic stuff, top of the line stuff. And we got more and more courses coming all the time, including, as I said, my Cold War course is coming, CJ Kilmer on how Woodrow Wilson is the worst person who ever lived, because of course he was the father of Hitler and Lenin and Stalin and Mao and Truman. And then also, we've got this guy, Adam Francisco, who is a Lutheran scholar from Concordia University, who's going to be debunking not exactly just dispensationalism, but essentially all of Christian Zionism from a highly educated and scholarly Protestant point of view there, which I think people are going to find very interesting. All that's coming. It's at scotthortonacademy.com. And you know what? If you do promo code Danny, give me like 20 minutes. And if you use promo code Danny, we'll get you a discount at scotthortonacademy.com.
Very good. Can I get the discount myself? I'm just
absolutely you can.
Very good. Well, listen, we really appreciate that, and look forward to hearing more about that as it goes going on, and what kind of response it may get. Any kind of something that's besides what just the standard old military-industrial congressional complex puts out there, which is like 95% of everything, all about something that has a different perspective. We're a big fan of it. So thanks for coming on, and look forward to seeing how that works out.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, sir.
And thank you very much, folks, for you coming out with us today. By the way, we're going to be back here in just about 35 minutes. America's Next Civil War Update 4. You know, I've been talking about a lot of the things that have been roiling in our past that give some dark possibilities if we don't make some changes. And so I've got this series where I'm going to be talking about what we need to avoid, what you need to be aware of. And given what happened in a lot of elections last night in New York, New Jersey, and right here in Virginia and California, things you need to know about, but things you might not be aware of if you're just watching the mainstream news, tune in at 3:30 p.m. today, and I will update you there. Look forward to seeing you then on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.